short timeline. We're on the floor at 3:30, but our schedule is pretty light next week, so anything that we don't get done today, we'll move into next week. Let's begin with work sessions on SJR 21 and 22. I see Senator Courtney has graced us. Senator Courtney's here. So I'll open work session on both 21 and 22. Okay. And we're in work session, but I'll welcome your testimony.
I'm just curious.
No.
Did you want to explain there's some amendments? I understand before you. Is that correct? They're not high committee.
I see dash A5s on Senate Joint Resolution 21.
Could I ask?
And A5s on 22.
Could I ask Mr. Yates to define what those are about?
Please. Let's start with 21, Dick.
You had the dash 4 amendments before you last time. The dash 5 are identical, except that we correctly refer to the State Board of Higher Education, since the State Board of Education doesn't own any buildings, and the university buildings are buildings that were intended to be included.
Okay. That's in the dash 21 that we have, the State Board of Higher Ed. Are they in 22 too?
No.
So what's the...
In 22, then, the amendment is on page 2. And has to do with what constitutes an emergency.
Mr. Chair, the 21 deals with educational buildings,
right.
K through
right.
I. 22 deals with hospitals, fire stations, and police stations.
Right.
Police station is a late arrival. A good question was sent forward. I carried another bill, and we did not include it. Senator Menace wanted to know why it should be. So the A5 amendments, the SJR 22, reflect on lines 15 through lines 19 on page 2. They reflect the addition of the police, if you will, as emergency services. So that's what those amendments are all about. And the other ones are about clarifying that the Oregon University
yeah.
system needs to be properly named. That's what these respective amendments do.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Does it matter? Don't we have a bill up that changes the name of the State Board of Higher Education into Oregon University System or Oregon? Grattan, come on up.
Well, Mr. Chair, I believe that would be changed as a conforming council
okay.
adjustment afterwards.
Okay.
This would not be a good primary bill in which to make the name change.
Oh, no, not a, yeah, right, not the name. I just want to make sure that this amendment that we've just made, we've amended it to a name that we're changing, and so some making a note that somebody will follow up to correct. Okay. Is that all you wanted to say, Grattan? Since you haven't said anything. Or did you have?
I did have something I wanted to submit for your record, but...
Okay, go ahead.
We're trying to expedite everything. That's why we're hardly talking here, Mr. Chair.
I appreciate this. I think last time we had this up, we spent more of our time getting our heads around HJR 46, and I think we do want to have some conversation on 21 and 22.
Mr. Chairman and members of the record, Grattan Ferens, Director of Government Relations of the Oregon University System, we've already talked about exercising rehab. The only thing I want to say is that I've submitted on that testimony the page 25 of our public recommended capital budget that shows you that in terms of our total education and general budget, the Article 11G bond debt cost is at 1.23% as a percentage of our general fund, your contribution to our general fund, 3.2%, a small amount of dollars, also very small in relation to our peers, and then added to your edification the front page of House Bill 2276, which is the bond budget law for this biennium. This is a 20-year-old law which was created in 1981 under OS 286525, governs all bonded debt because there was concern in the committee of the, I think your term, Mr. Chairman, was sticker shock. If all of these authorities were passed, it would then be up to you in future legislative sessions to apportion that under the bond budget law. And so that if you pass $500 million, there might be no more than $50 million in a session that would be appropriate, so they are apportioned out. And so that's a fairly prudent thing to do, fiscally responsible, and I don't think it's compromised in terms of its pace.
Okay. We are in work session on 21 and 22. I guess let me ask this. Both of these refer to funds for planning and implementation of seismic rehabilitation. I take it it's conceivable that, I mean, there's no limitation, of course, on how much would be spent on planning. And I guess what I'm getting at is there was a talk in the Senate about the propriety of the policy of using bonding to pay for planning. And normally bonding goes into bricks, mortar, bond costs, and things like this, but this is bonding planning. And the prospect that we may have enough general fund money to bond at the front end provide the debt service for the planning element, but then what if we don't get that the next infusion of general fund money to step up the bond commitments? Now we're paying off the cost of planning for 20 years or however many years these bonds are, and we haven't got any improvements by them.
Mr. Chairman, Grant Insurance again. My understanding is, and we have other witnesses who could come up if misstated, that's architectural, engineering, and other planning relative to a project, which is incorporated in the project itself, in addition to cost of materials, labor, et cetera, for the actual capital construction.
I guess I would add, just in terms of having followed through that there are sort of two planning stages. And the first planning stage, which is an analysis and examination of all structures, is in Senate Bills 14 and 15, I believe. And Dogami will be doing that. And that money, if it's going to be done, will be funded from the general fund.
Okay. And I guess that would be a matter of the implementing legislation anyway, to determine what the legislature wanted to pay for or didn't want to pay for within that ambit of planning. Other questions?
Want a motion?
Well, make sure we talk this one through. Yes, Representative.
Just so you know, early this morning, as I walked in the Senate floor, I did receive a notification from John Bolio, the head of Dogami, asking me not to mention this until noon because they were meeting with officials in Milwaukee. They had just discovered that a major middle school in Milwaukee has been built over a major trench. And they did this because they were doing further digging for trenches because they want to expand the school. All I'm saying to you is, had this been California, that school never would have been built there. And this is not the main fault they have just discovered. Again, another example of, as I speak to you, and I don't know what the press is going to do with this because they have announced to the press, they had met with officials at noon today to tell them what they found. So, again, the school issue is paramount. We've got hospitals right as we speak. And I don't want to overkill. It's just that people think I orchestrate all these things. I didn't ask for this to happen as I walked on the floor. And here are the reports, and it's pretty alarming. I don't know the name of the school, but here is a middle school, as we speak, literally over a fault. And they were going to expand, and then the Gombe Center really got involved, and they found out, sure enough, they just discovered it. And that's the kind of thing that we are having to deal with each legislative session from now in perpetuity. So thank you very much for all your time and effort. And
don't go away.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative.
Please stay. You want to sit up?
I'm having a bad day, so really.
No, me too. So am I.
I really am having a bad day.
Right. Representative Kefouri, how's your day going?
Would you like some candy?
Thank you. I'm really just struggling.
I don't talk about it.
Quick.
Representative Williams. I'm sorry, Beck, you had
that. I had a comment because Senator Courtney has this uncanny ability to introduce legislation in response or usually presaging catastrophic events.
He's our canary.
Yes, he is our canary. That is correct. So I am heartened to know that by introducing this legislation, in all likelihood, there will be a catastrophic event in the October time frame of 2002, which will certainly propel voters to support these measures.
Representative Williams.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know that we had a discussion, and I don't know that we've really revisited that discussion earlier in the committee about our concern having passed HJR 46 mm-hmm. out to the floor. And I believe, when did we vote on that? Have we voted on it yet?
It's up this afternoon.
It's up this afternoon. Okay, well, I'll be in my Measure 7 committee. But the concern about having all three of these issues out on the ballot, I know that HJR 7 is planning to hit, or excuse me, HJR 66 is planning to hit at a different date, or 64. But I guess I'm just, I'm still somewhat unresolved about having three of these separate bonding issues coming out of this legislature and how they'll be received. And I know Senator Courtney's given this a lot of thought. I just don't know, frankly, if you've got any words of advice or wisdom, Senator, on that issue.
Sure, Shirley, Representative Williams. I understand the 46, which is the, isn't that the one that is?
It's about $1
billion. $1 billion. It's going to be in spring. So it's up in the springtime. It won't be on this. These are going in November, the general election of November 2002. There's a risk. I admit that. But this allows the public an opportunity to choose what level of funding, if there are any, they want to use to deal with the earthquake coming. I don't know. You can't do it in the general funds. You can't do it in the lottery. There's no other mechanism that I could come up with that's realistic to get this job done. And we've screwed down the price unbelievably low. I don't know. I can't tell you that. I don't know what to do. I can't be afraid to act because there's been so much done through the initiative process and the referral process. There's been so much on the ballot, and as a result, the voter's pamphlet is now not one but two volumes. I don't know how else to deal with your question. The comfort I have is the other major one is on at a different time. I don't know.
Sure.
Yes.
Senator, I mean, let me ask you this. I know you will be an outspoken proponent for the passage of these two measures. Other than you and the limited effort that Dogami can make in their role as a government agency to support this, are there other groups or organizations that are coming forward that are going to help sort of move this into some sort of a visible position in the election cycle? Have you made plans with respect to that issue?
I have not put together any coalition except that there is a coalition that helped draft these bills that involves higher education, K through 12, the community colleges, the hospitals, now the police and the fire, they mentioned a few, and obviously you go to them, they're public service groups that serve the public in many ways, and it would be my hope and belief, given the way they've taken possession of this, that they, through their own avenues and tools, will get the word out, at least to their constituencies, that they think these are good bills. Also, Representative Shirley, Representative Williams, it's my understanding at this time, the usual no people probably are not going to surface on these measures, to be very frank with you. Now, I asked a certain player directly, what are you going to do on these measures? And to my surprise, I said to you last time, he said, no, I'm not going to oppose him. I support him because his house is built over a fault. So I don't know how else. I have not had time to put together a coalition or a large funding war chest to promote these things. So I have not put together a campaign war chest or campaign organization at this moment to get these passed if you put them on the ballot. However, I've identified the forces and sources that have taken possession of these things and wanted to pass. Hopefully, we can move those forces and sources into a campaign warrior mode and go forward.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Beck.
Would you like the motion?
Well, since I divine that the votes are there to pass this out, these out, I suppose we should. We feel like we've made a sufficient record on it. I'll just say, as I did with 46, I will support these with some trepidation, putting understand that these don't obligate us to a dollar, but that together with 46, they certainly invite requests for funding that without some additional resources, at some point, we're never going to be able to satisfy. And I guess the danger that you're worried about if they don't pass, I'm almost worried if they do, the danger that we'll have folks see these as an opportunity to get at some state resources, and they're going to come and find the well dry and wonder why we asked. But if you know, I understand it takes one step at a time to get down the trail, and I suppose this is another step. I'll do it. Representative Beck.
Mr. Chairman, I would move the A5 amendments to SJR 21.
Representative Beck moves the A5 amendments to SJR 21. Is there any discussion? Any objection? There you go, Representative Beck.
I would move SJR 21A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Beck moves SJR 21 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion on that? John, please call the roll.
Representative
Beck. Aye.
Beck.
Aye.
Brown.
Aye.
Half.
Aye.
William.
Aye.
Webb.
Excused.
Aye.
Aye.
Chair
Shatterly. Aye. SJR 21 goes to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. Do we have a carrier? Representative Hannes. Oh, a bond back. Okay. Okay, we are still in work session on 22.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Beck.
I would move the dash A5 or dash 5 amendments to SJR 22.
Representative Beck moves the A5 amendments to SJR 22. Is there discussion on that motion? Any objection? Therein, Representative Beck.
Move SJR 22 as amended, SJR 22A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Beck moves SJR 22A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion on that motion? Please call the roll.
Aye.
Beck.
Aye.
Brown.
Aye.
Half.
Aye.
William.
Aye.
Webb.
Excused.
Aye.
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 Do you know it like that?
Aye. SJR 22 as amended to the floor. Pass recommendation. We need a carrier on that.
You want me to do both of them?
Sure. Here. Yeah, okay. Thank you, Senator. Okay. Let's go to, we're going to wait before we get to 660 until we can get Senator Atkinson down here. So let's go to Senate Bill 684. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 684. Have you got a sign-up sheet?
It's a May basket.
They brought them all down. Hope it happens at night on a weekend when nobody's there. It's 300 years a long time.
Welcome, Elizabeth. Please.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, with Senate Bill 684, what this does, it exempts from taxation real and personal property of a rural health care facility under the following conditions. Only the new construction or the new personal or real machinery of the facility can be exempt from taxation, and the exemption must first be approved by the county governing body, and then it has to be authorized by the other local taxing district that is in the code area at which the facility is located. The health care facility has to be located in a remote rural health care service area, and the average travel time to the facility is more than 30 minutes from a population center of 30,000 people or more. Now, if a local taxing district is approving this property tax exemption for health care facilities, all new health care facilities which meet those conditions in the measure shall be granted this three-year property tax exemption. The property tax exemption begins after a facility is in service or after July 1st, 2002. And you have a Dash 2 amendment, and basically that is replacing Section 2 of the bill and some other minor changes. And if you, for those of you who were on revenue last session, in 99 we approved House Bill 2079, and this measure allowed a property tax exemption for long-term care facilities, and this included nursing homes, assisted living facilities, and other residential care facilities and adult foster homes. And in that particular exemption, this was granted also only if the governing body of each of the local taxing districts then adopted this property tax exemption by ordinance. The difference, though, with this property tax exemption is it applied to all the real and personal property of a long-term care facility, not just the new construction, which this one has. And it began in July 1st, 2000, but as of 2001, there have not been any long-term care facilities that have been approved by local governments for that property tax exemption. This is brought to you by the Clackamas County Board of Commissioners, who have indicated interest in wanting to provide a property tax exemption for new health care facilities.
Say Clackamas or
Clackamas?
Yeah, okay. I think she said Clackamas.
But... Sorry.
Okay. Oh, okay. George.
And from there on, I just.
Yes. And Tom Winharris. Commissioner?
Yes.
Oh, welcome. Please, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, member of the committee, my name is George Kipke. I'm chairman of the Clatsop County Board of Commissioners. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on Senate Bill 684. After explaining the intent of this bill, I'd like to introduce the Dash 2 amendments, or at least briefly speak about those. All rural counties face significant problems providing health and well-being for our residents. And within our rural communities, and I'll speak of Clatsop County, what we traditionally do is what we stabilize, and then we have to send our residents out of Clatsop County to a metro area in order to be able to get the treatment they need to take care of the condition that they are in. And talking with quite a few professionals over the years, they would like to have opportunities to come into rural counties, but they have huge investments. And one of the investments that have been brought to my attention is a dialysis machine, which is very expensive. Now, we do have a dialysis machine that was brought into Clatsop County, and the individual invested with his health care facility and the equipment in it in excess of $3 million, and I understand he's also included more investment in that facility. Tillamook County Commissioner Tim Josie has also expressed they have interest in a dialysis machine in that county also, but then they are again strapped to find somebody willing to put that kind of investment within a rural community. Coos County Commissioner has also expressed interest in this legislation to bring health care facilities treatments in their areas. So it's not just exclusive to one county, but there's quite a few rural counties that have interest in this legislation to help them provide better health care for rural communities. One thing about this bill, it does not apply to medical facilities or equipment that are currently on the tax roll. It only exempts any new construction or expansion or new equipment that goes into an existing building. It also, the bill requires local taxing districts to agree if they wish to grant this property tax exemption to the applications. And the other is that the area that it talks about for rural definition, and I'm found out today I'm not the person that should be asked for correct definitions, because I assumed what the definition was, and I guess that's a mistake on my part today. But rural means 30 minutes, within 30 minutes of the population of 30 miles. That's how that is defined in this bill. This legislation is needed more today than it was at the time that we thought of this bill. Now, census has reported that we have a increase within the elderly population in the rural communities, and I know that that trend is continually going upward, and in the future we are going to have to do something for our elderly population other than stabilizing and transporting to metro area. That's all I really have at this point. You have my written testimony in front of you, and I would, in closing, I'd like to ask your support to bring current medical practices and technologies and new physicians to rural counties. And I request that you pass this bill out of committee with a due pass recommendation. This bill was passed out of the Senate with a 28-0 vote. Thank you.
Questions?
I've got a few.
Yeah.
I've got a few for you.
You start.
Mr. Chairman, I'm a physician, as you might have known or not known before, and I've been pretty active in healthcare across the state, and I'm well aware of the serious problems facing rural parts of the state as far as healthcare is concerned. Also aware, unfortunately, that a lot of rural areas cannot efficiently, and not only efficiently cost-wise, but efficiently as far as patient care, give the care that big cities do because of the numbers involved. We saw a case this morning. We're talking about trauma care for pediatric patients, and there's been some serious questions asked about rural areas trying to hold on to those patients, take care of when they should get them out of there. And there's been some tragedies because of that. So having said those things, the first thing I was concerned about when I read this bill is what's the definition of a health care facility? That's kind of a wide statement. We clearly need primary care centers in rural areas. We also need ways of rapidly and efficiently transferring patients who are seriously ill to major medical centers. So do you have a definition for a health care facility? Do you have a clear understanding of what this law says that's going to be?
My understanding for the rural health facilities would be for medical facilities, for medical treatment for patients. What I would like to say that this bill does not restrict any patient to be sent out of a rural community, because we know that we will not be able to provide every type of treatment that a metropolitan area can provide. This is to complement any of the current practices that could be there, so they could go a step further than what we currently can right now. As I said, what we basically are doing is stabilizing. We're not able to treat a lot of different medical problems in rural communities. And I know we've had some accidents just recently in Clatsop County, and because we don't have the expertise or the facility set up in a rural community, we have to flight those individuals out. And by the time they get into the metro area, it doesn't take very long to treat those patients. But if we would be able to put some new facilities in and some new physicians with their specialties and equipment, we should be able to take up some of the smaller traumas that we're currently sending out into the rural communities.
Can I offer something here?
Yes.
You know, we have in the, I'm aware of this because I just caught up with the Senate bill to request an amendment on the rural medical practitioner tax, income tax credit. We have already in law a pretty comprehensive and specific definition of rural hospital is what it gets at there. Are you aware of that? I'm looking here, it's in ORS 316-143. that's, you know, type A, hospital designated as such by the Office of Rural Health, or type B, as long as it's, you know, not too proximate to a type C or a rural critical access hospital. I mean, would it be easier to incorporate that kind of pre-existing definition of at least a rural hospital? Are we talking hospitals here?
We're talking physician offices here? Are we talking trauma treatment centers?
Not nursing homes, because we took care of long-term care facilities last session.
I'm not trying to beat up on you.
We
believe this is for medical facilities and for-profit hospitals. Because we have current community hospitals, and as everyone knows, those are not going to need any kind of an exemption. So if there is a hospital that is for-profit, same way as a medical facility, then I believe that's what this definition would apply to. And if there is an ORS that is already fits that definition, then I welcome that.
Tom, why don't you weigh in? How was your vacation?
Which vacation?
I don't know, you're saying.
Which vacation?
I'll lie and say I went to the Rotary District Conference in Sun River.
Uh-huh.
All I did was drop the exchange students off and then went on vacation. Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom Linhares. I'm the Columbia County Assessor and representing the Oregon State Association of County Assessors. We looked at the statutes and we couldn't come up with a definition that was already in statute, because the statute you referred to, I think, is limited to hospitals.
It is.
Where the intent is for if a doctor wants to bring in a piece of diagnostic equipment or something like that, then that might fall outside of the definition that's in statute. We are concerned that the definition on line 17, page 1 of the bill, is too broad.
Well, let's look at the dash 2s, because that replaces everything down to line 22.
Well, but I think the language in that line is the same.
What line is it on the 2?
I guess I have the dash 1, Mr. Chair.
I have no dash. I just have the original bill, is all.
Don't you have dash 2s? They were in the packet, I thought, on my desk.
Yeah, you should have dash 2s.
Oh, I didn't have them last night. Sorry.
Okay, where'd it go? Where'd it go? It was little B.
Little B?
Okay, line 7 of the dash 2 amendment. Okay. Serves local or regional health care needs. Well, to me, that could be a nursing home, it could be a physical therapist, it could be a health gym. So what I would recommend, and I've had some disagreements on this, but I think it accomplishes the purpose of the bill, that line 17 would read, line 7, is used exclusively to provide medical care. That wording is used elsewhere in statute. Religious organizations are exempt if they're used exclusively for religious purposes. Charitable is exempt if it's used exclusively. So we have case law, administrative rules, which tell us what the word exclusively means. And I think that narrows the definition. And that would include hospitals. It would include a private physician who wanted to bring in a piece of diagnostic equipment. I think that does the trick.
Yes. I'm sorry, Representative Bates, are you done? You said you had a few.
I had a few questions. You know, this is the kind of questions I have would be the ones you'd probably want to do in a committee, and time is of an essence here, and
we got time. We're going in next week.
I hate to drag everybody into this.
This is a Senate bill.
We can beat up on them.
No, just means we got a little time.
The first question was, of course, the definition of this is way, way too broad. And I think what you suggested may well solve that problem. Okay, at least now we know it's for medical needs. The second question I had is, did you enroll any physicians who work in a rural area to try to define what you're trying to get to here? I mean, we have a lot of organizations that can be put into 501Ks that are tax exempt. We have A and B type hospitals out there that are funded entirely from anyplace else on a cost basis. They're very expensive but maintained because we think we need those for rural people. I'm not sure that what you're trying to get here is something I understand as a, even as a physician. But I think of Lakeview and other areas and the facilities they have there, we don't want to be in a position that we're looking at a population that needs to be served, and when clearly the best way to serve them is to air evac them out, we're trying to hold on to them. That's one of the problems we're dealing with right now with NICUs. That's neonatal intensive care units where babies are held too long in the rural area and not brought in quickly enough. Trauma patients are being held back too long, and complicated medical cases are being held back too long. We don't want to move in the wrong direction. Your centralization has been shown to clearly produce better patient outcomes, and we are moving towards programs where even in places like Medford, we're shipping more and more to Portland because we feel it's better medical care. And that's with a place that has 300 hospital beds, 275 doctors, and yet subspecialties up here can do a better job. We formed alliance with OHSU, and Emmanuel will take care of those things. So I'm a little concerned that are we really answering a need the rural community has, or is this a move in the wrong direction? That's a policy decision and a big one. And I'd like to have a little conversation about that right now before I vote on this. Too much stuff, right? I'm sorry.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Bates, my intent was never to replace any of the metropolitan areas medical professionals or any of their techniques. My desire was only to improve any medical health that we could possibly provide to rural residents. And I've seen a need, and I guess I need to talk about a personal issue I have. My son had a congenital heart defect, and unfortunately, we didn't even have the basic needs to help that child out. We had to travel with him to three different locations where we finally stopped at OSHU treatment. I think that we need to be able to have the tools in rural areas to help out basic needs. If it turns into a major need, yes, we need to go ahead and transport them to a metro area. But when they diagnosed my child as having
take another question? Tom.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bates, one thing I'd like to point out is one of the things I like about this bill is it is short-term, and it's only for new construction. So a doctor or a company, this isn't going to be enough of an incentive for somebody to build something that isn't going to pay off in the long run. It might give them a 3-year property tax break, allows them to get on their feet, get established, and so maybe cash flow is there to sustain them after the third year. Certainly, they're not going to be building a 300-bed hospital in Burns.
I would think not.
So I just wanted to point that out that it is only for new construction and it's only short term.
Representative Hanson, let's get your figures up.
Yeah, I think Representative Bates got to it.
Right.
Just following up on the points he made on the definition.
Let me ask on that definition, too, back up on lines 4 and 5 of the dash 2s. I had a little trouble with that. It says located in a rural health service area. I guess, first of all, is there a do we have that? Okay. With an average travel time of more than 30 minutes. But from what point in the area to what point in the population center? Going back again to the rural medical health care practitioner's tax credit, you got 30 miles to the from the hospital to from the rural hospital to the hospital that's in the metropolitan statistical area, whatever that is. You got a pretty well defined point A and point B. This doesn't really define point A and point B, and it refers to it in terms of time.
Mr. Chair, that was on the Senate. In the Senate committee, I had that same concern. Afterwards,
my mother traveling.
I got this piece of paper. It's actually from the Office of Rural Health at OHSU, and they define what is a rural county.
Okay.
They also 30 minutes, but there's in mountainous terrain, under normal conditions, or in flat terrain. So, you know, my suggestion on the Senate side was we'll just make it 30 miles. Mm-hmm. But after I saw this, and even though the bill doesn't reference this, I think we would use it, I guess it made more sense to me to leave the bill as it is, knowing that there's this definition out here that talks about it probably takes longer to get somewhere in Burns in the winter than it does Clatsop County in the summer. I don't know.
Can we get copies of that, please? Yeah, if John has some or John has one. I'd be interested to see that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, other questions? Tom, have you covered your concerns or comments on the bill? You touched on it.
Assessors really don't like local option. but I think what I would like to suggest, and it doesn't have to be part of the bill, is there seems to be each bill that comes along, that proposes local option, seems to go about it in a different way. So I'd like to get together with the Department of Revenue and counties and special districts and cities during the interim and say, okay, if we're going to be doing this local option thing, let's have a standard procedure for how that works so we don't have as many different procedures as there are exemptions that have local option. This is actually a better one than the one in 99, because the one in 99, it was just willy-nilly. At least in this one, they've got to go to the county governing body first. Only if the county governing body approves the exemption can they then go to the city, the fire district, school district, and ask for the exemption. So that seems like a better approach than the long-term care facility local option from last session. That's a concern. I think we'll deal with it during the interim, hopefully.
Anything else? Well, Tom, you suggested, and I guess, Commissioner, I would ask you what you think from Representative Bates about that language on line 7, sub B, referring to used exclusively to provide medical care. How do you feel about that? Is that in the spirit of what you were after with this?
Mr. Chair, I don't have a problem with that word. I wish I would have known better of interpretations prior to with the dash 2.
Don't worry about it.
Get involved in budgets.
We find ourselves tripping over these things daily.
Can we conceptually amend that at this point?
Well, I don't know that we need to. I guess I would rather make sure that LC is comfortable with that language. It's not that I don't trust Tom, but I'd rather have LC work it. John, do you have any comments about this from DOR and your perspective? Representative Bates, when he's coming up, you were concerned about the definition of rural health care facility. If we use that language exclusively to provide medical care, does that take care of...
That would serve the purpose as far as...
It's much what the institution is, it's what the purpose of the equipment or facility that's being used. Okay.
And I would say that this goes to a local issue, and I would hope that the local practitioners and people in that community would be wise enough to make reasonable decisions about what they want to build in their community.
Well, and I think if you're asking the County Board of Commissioners to give up some property tax, they're going to have to be pretty well persuaded that it's
worthwhile.
Mm-hmm.
I leave that up to local authorities to make that decision with the caveat that, you know, think twice about it, and I'm sure they probably will.
John Phillips, Department of Revenue. Thank you. We made several suggestions after the Senate heard the bill, and in one of the two of them are addressed in the dash 2. So one of them was a filing deadline, and they've addressed that.
Okay.
The other was the broad definition, and so the suggestion that was made will make it easier. We can administer it either way. It's just whatever your policy, you know, decision is.
Okay. Well, John, do you know? And Tom, I'm not adverse to a conceptual amendment. It's a few more words than we usually do by conceptual amendment, but do you think used exclusively to provide medical care provides enough guidance for the department and the county commissioners and the county assessors to administer this? Or would you be more comfortable to have legislative council look at this?
We asked our staff in the exemptions program about this, and they looked for definitions, and they tried to find a way to narrow it or to give you opportunity or options to narrow it, and we couldn't really find anything either.
Let's have LC look at it then and understand that that's the direction we want to go, and we'll give Dexter a chance to work with Tom or you on that. Representative Carlson?
If you're going to send it to LC rather than conceptually amending, another area that you might want to look at on line four is located in a rural health service area. You might say as defined by Oregon Health Sciences University, or reference it to some other point so we know who's
actually defining. That's a good idea, but if someone is looking at this, it gives them a clue that there's something else to refer to in defining what is a rural health service area.
You might give them another clue what to look at. There's a federal statute involved in this, which they use for determining rural health needs, and actually having some tax exemption for physicians to go into underserved areas, but they also have a definition for that might be helpful too. And I expect Dexter to know that what that is. Either one might be acceptable and would make this language clear for you.
How about that? On the handout we've got, remote rural areas are more than 30 minutes average travel time, and we've got a map here that tells us what are remote and, I got frontier too. See, that's very interesting. This refers to, I guess the frontier would fall even under remote. Okay. Anything else? Elizabeth, you can take those to Dexter and get some amendments. Dexter's probably listening anyway, but, okay, thanks very much, Commissioner, and Tom, and John. John, I wanted to give you a chance to show off in front of your boss, too. You did a good job. It's a lot better than your usual performance. So pleased you were able to do that under pressure today. Deborah, you're next. Okay, let's close the work session on Senate Bill 684. Okay, Director Harchenko, I was kidding. John does a tremendous job down here every day. Mm-hmm. Come on up. Let's have you talk about 660. We'll go to that next. We need to move on.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee for the.
Oh, wait a second. Let Dick kind of bring us up to speed here.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Dick Cates with Legislative Revenue. Senate Bill 660 deals with essentially prohibiting taxation of something relating to the Internet. You have a number of amendments. The original bill was Senate Bill 660 was amended in the House and comes to you as 660A. And what it does is essentially prohibit Oregon, which includes the state and any political subdivision thereof, from imposing a tax, fee, or charge on access or use of the Internet. It does, in this case, not grandfather in existing taxes. That's one of the provisions here that I've tried to do in this little table I've given you.
Yep.
Is to summarize the amendments that are available to me. Now, some have not surfaced here. At least I'm not aware of them, i.e. 1, 2, and 3,
yeah,
and so on. So with respect to that prohibition, some of these amendments say, well, if there was a tax fee or charge in existence before the effective date of this act, that's allowed to continue. So whether that provision is in there or not is yes or yes, no answer there. The bill, as it comes to you, also prevents Oregon from collecting another state tax or political subdivision of another state, again, if the tax fee or charge is on access or use of the Internet. And the bill happens, Representative Witt was concerned about the fact that it then says, well, it's okay if the legislature passes a provision allowing local governments or the state itself to impose such a fee. What you have then in the 4, 5, 6, and 7 are a number of ways in which there's an attempt to kind of narrow what it is you're talking about and to really try and concentrate, I think, on access charges as opposed to simply transactions that may involve use of the Internet. Some of them involve the prohibition again on collection of other state taxes, and some do not. And some bring in the cable, the question of cable services. Usually they're exempting telecommunication services, and then some of the amendments add cable services. And in those cases, they're dealing with a situation where there's a pending court case right now as to whether or not a phone line, a cable line, which does not transmit voice but just data, falls under the federal law or not. And so they're trying to deal with the conditions which may come out of that final determination under that case. So that's basically what's before you, and the issues that are involved.
Okay. We'll need to get a sense as we go through this, which amendments work with which amendments and which are outright alternatives. But Ms. Harchenko, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You didn't get a chance, I don't think, last time. Did you?
No.
That's right. Yeah, so please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Elizabeth Harchenko, Director of your Department of Revenue. I'm here today to talk to you actually about internet taxation at multiple levels. When the Senate considered Senate Bill 660, I spoke with the Senate Revenue Committee and talked to them about what's going on nationally and how it affects what's happening here, so that you have a sort of a full background against which to consider this piece of legislation. The Congress had passed in 1998 a federal Internet Tax Freedom Act, and that act prohibited any state or local tax on Internet access and prohibited multiple or discriminatory taxes on electronic commerce. That moratorium will expire in October of this year, and there has been very active consideration and discussion on Capitol Hill about extending the prohibition. The discussion that I've been paying attention to, I've not heard of any member of Congress saying that the prohibition should not be extended. The debate has been around whether it should be for another fixed period of time, such as 4 years or 6 years, or permanently. So there is already in place a prohibition on state, town, local taxation of access to the Internet and use of the Internet. And I fully expect that it will be extended for some period of time. There are quite a few issues that are under debate in connection with extending the moratorium, and one of those is the definition of Internet access. As time goes on and technology continues to change, there are many dimensions to access to and use of the Internet that are becoming reality. And I always think about Dick Tracy and his two-way wrist radio when I was a kid reading the Sunday Funnies and thinking how wonderful it would be if we really could have such things, and now they are. The bill currently, the federal legislation, calls Internet access one of two things: either service that enables a user to access information or content that is available on the World Wide Web, or email, or other services that are available through that technology. And it also includes access to proprietary content, information, or other services that are packaged together with access to the Internet or the World Wide Web. And one of the issues that is being debated now and discussed in the deliberations in the Congress is whether both of those parts ought to still be there. What has happened over time is there are companies that have grown up and have offered strictly the communications aspect of access to the Internet, which is the Internet service provider that you just go out through, and then you go onto the web and you use a browser from somewhere else and you look for content from somewhere else, or you can buy services from somewhere else, but that Internet service provider doesn't offer you content or entertainment or data or services
themselves, and then there are others who provide not only access to the internet to get at those things, but also provide those things as a part of a package of services so that the subscriber has access to the whole World Wide Web as well as access to entertainment or proprietary content or data that the internet service provider itself as a business is.
That's awesome, like AOL.
Yeah. That's a good example.
Are there high-profile names of the other kind that just give you access but no...
In the cable side, AT&T broadband is also does the same thing. You get the access to the internet wherever you want to go on the internet, but you also have the bundled services of news and video and a variety of other things that are all available as a part of that monthly fee.
But those are where you're getting content as well as access.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. We're also seeing over time, fairly rapidly, not only a bundling of services, but also convergence of services and the ability to provide over the same basic medium of transmission, internet access, telecommunications, television, et cetera. And that also makes, from sort of the tax administrator's perspective, a challenge of trying to figure out which of these things is actually is some part of this internet access, is this whole thing internet access, even if it's usable for multiple purposes, only one of which is internet access. So those are issues that are being debated at the federal level as the discussion about extending this prohibition goes on. There are some related issues that are specifically being discussed and considered at the federal level as well in connection with taxation of the internet. And some of those affect Oregon directly and others don't. I serve as the chair of the Multi-State Tax Commission. Oregon is a member by virtue of the fact that Oregon enacted the Multi-State Tax Compact as a law here. 26 other states have enacted that compact. And we have many other states that have associated with the commission as associate members. And I became the chair in January of the commission. So I was asked to go back and testify on behalf of the commission to the Senate Commerce Committee in March. And so I discussed with the committee the fact that sales tax is a really big issue that's related to the internet and transactions that take place over the internet. States that have sales taxes and rely on those as a big source of funding for government, as well as local governments that rely on sales taxes. I have expressed a lot of concern about their ability to compel a remote seller, whether they're selling through the internet or selling through mail order or telephone, to collect sales tax on sales that are made to consumers within their state. And the states have been working very hard on a streamlined project to take all of the disparate state and local sales taxes and unify the administration of those. And so I discussed that with the committee. Another dimension that's being discussed and which is a feature of some of the bills that have been proposed is a restriction on the state's ability to impose business activity taxes. And in Oregon, our primary business activity taxes are corporate excise tax. Some of the versions of the legislation that are out there and some amendments that have been circulated would establish a minimum threshold of activity by interstate business in a state before the state could impose its tax basically for the privilege of doing business within the state. And the current discussion is circulating around a proposal that a company must have a significant number of employees or a significant amount of property in the taxing state before the state could impose its corporate doing business or business activity tax. The states have been trying to estimate the effect of that proposal, and our estimates are that the current proposal that's being discussed could reduce Oregon's corporate excise tax collections between $7.5 and $11 million a year by basically exempting many companies that have very little in the way of property or people here, even if they have significant amount of sales activity. So that's another piece that's being connected to this debate about the extension of the internet tax moratorium. I would note for you there's a potential interaction between that proposal and the discussion that's taking place here in the legislature about changing the state corporate income tax apportionment formula to put more weight on the sales factor. That if the proposal that's being considered in the Congress passes, those companies that have a lot of sales here, that I think the anticipation would be they would be paying more tax, will be exempt from Oregon excise tax. So there's an interplay potential that bears watching. Finally, one of the core issues that's related or swirling around this internet tax moratorium extension is the relationship between the federal government and the states themselves in terms of achieving simplification of sales tax systems that were put in place when the economy was really very much local and not global in the way it is today, and whether the Congress should be directing the states in what their tax structure should look like and how they should be defined, or working in partnership with the states to help them bring some of these tax systems that are 30 and 40 years old into the modern economy. Are there any questions about sort of what's going on nationally?
Thank you for the overview questions. Yes, Representative Wood.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Archenko, the federal law simply says no tax on internet use or access. It has nothing to do with commerce that's done over the internet. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Witt, the federal law prohibits taxes on access to the internet or use of the internet. Federal law does not currently address taxation of sales or transactions that are completed through the internet technology. That's correct.
Yeah, thank you.
Yes, Representative Cass.
Mr. Archenko, do you think this legislation is necessary?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hass, if the internet moratorium is extended at the federal level, it would certainly make this moot if the language of this measure is consistent with or intended to be consistent with that federal moratorium. The federal law would clearly apply to Oregon and all the other states.
Representative Witt?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Archenko, that's only on the A engrossed version of the bill, though, correct? Because the original bill banned all taxes on commerce and over the internet.
Mr. Chair, Representative Witt, I'm trying to address the bill that is before you.
So the A engrossed version?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay. Do you want to talk about...
I was prepared to address the bill. I just wanted to see if there were any questions about sort of that national picture, which continues to change.
Yeah.
Yay!
Come to order.
What Senator Bach has been saying.
What you have before you, Senate Bill 660, A engrossed, would bar taxes, fees, or charges for on access to the internet or use of the internet. I believe the printed bill that you have doesn't define access to the internet, but you have some amendments that would define access to the internet, but the printed bill does not do that. And there are one of the things that I would suggest as you think about and consider the amendments that have been provided to you is that you make this as specific as you can make it. The measure itself, because it's designed to prohibit activity by the state or the local government, clearly the legislature today or in the future can amend state statutes. So the constraints on the state are minimal as long as if in the future the legislature chooses to tax something that the bill would address, that there is some memory that this is out there and creates an exception to it. But for local government, there would potentially be some confusion for taxpayers and local taxing districts if there is a definition that ends up being inconsistent with the federal definition. And that's why I wanted to be sure you understood that there's a lot of debate about what the definition ought to be of internet access and some serious conversation about changing it from the way it's defined in the current federal law into something different that recognizes that the bundling of content and proprietary information together with access and creating an exemption for that creates a difference in the playing field between businesses that choose to provide content or data or entertainment that is accessible through the web but don't package it together with internet access itself as a service. As the bill is currently written, there is a broad interpretation of it could possibly result in the conclusion that service fees for government-provided internet services might be prohibited. And we do have some local governments that are trying to provide access to the internet for their citizens, but they need to charge a fee in order to provide the service. Finally, and I do believe it would take a pretty broad reading of the bill as drafted, but as I mentioned, Oregon is a member of the Multi-State Tax Commission, and that organization of states is working towards uniform administration of state taxes. We cooperate with one another in many ways, including conducting joint audits. Although we do not currently have any programs in place on joint collection of taxes, we do financially support one another and support a staff, our ability to participate in that might be called into question because the language right now is somewhat general.
Let me interrupt, if I may, and welcome our friend and former representative, Senator Atkinson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir.
For the record, my name is Jason Atkinson, State Senator. There's a lot of you on this committee. And
kind of scary, huh?
I'm scared. Both
your recording was petrified.
Many of you are friends of mine, and I feel a bit of payback coming. I don't know why I feel this way. I just feel this way.
You can, too. Where have you been?
What's that, Senator? A representative? We have skylights in the Senate. Well, all those long hours.
About the elder violet, that is not the answer. Nice try.
We are here on Senate Bill 660. Thank you very much for giving it a hearing. This particular measure, I don't know what's been covered. I'm sorry, I'm in the Rules Committee. I'll tell you briefly that my interest in the bill began following e-commerce in the realm of e-commerce, not only through my own business, but also through an interest in what it's done in rural Oregon. In 1998, as you know, someone probably has told you, the federal moratorium on internet taxes, specifically some access issues, ran through both chambers of the United States Congress. The year 2000 made it through the House of Representatives. It did not get through the Senate, and Senator Ron Wyden then went to bat to try to see if he couldn't get that all the way through the entire process to continue the moratorium. Many states, including I thought it would be good of us to follow along with the national trend and try to create essentially a moratorium of our own to allow it to take place and to allow this part of the economy to continue to grow. So that's what brings you to today. The version that we got through the Senate was good. We did take quite a bit of testimony regarding definitions. And I believe that working with people to get it to this point, Mr. Chair, produces the dash sevens definitional portion of the bill. And then also...
Okay, so I want to make sure. I'm going to put your name on the dash sevens.
Sure.
Okay. Okay, thanks.
Yeah. Correct. And that largely came out of conversation we had not only as the bill began, but also as it has traveled around for its 5 months of life. The dash tens, which I support also, get at some more of the specifics of the bill with regards to commerce.
Let me just interrupt here. Secretary Harchenko, I think dash 10s were ones that you had, that we had looked at. Were these the dash 10s as part of our conversation earlier this week? Just trying to keep the players straight here and who's on board with the different amendments.
Like Solomon.
That's the one that, yeah. Watch us split it. That's the one that takes out the reference to content.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay. And Senator, your...
Yes, I'm supportive.
Okay, on the dash 10. Okay. Okay, please. What else?
I think there's been quite a bit of testimony at this point. I'd be more than happy to attempt to answer questions. I will also say that we began down this road, and the lady sitting on my left and I found ourselves in a similar circumstance before the Senate committee trying to work out what we're trying to do here, especially definitionally, and I will report to the committee with some confidence that she has excellent taste in Chinese food, because the last time I saw her, she was picking up takeout for her husband and her. And so it's nice to see you either Chinese food or before the Lester's House Committee. With that, I'd be more than happy to answer any questions now.
We have about 2 minutes of questions for the Senator. Committee will, we are not excused from the floor since we're not shut down this week. They want us there. And we will need to let you know we need to go back into the work session on SJR 21 and 22. It came to our attention after the vote on those that those had subsequent referrals to Ways and Means that we need to go in, and we have approval to rescind those and send them straight to the floor, so we need to finish that too before we adjourn. But let's take now a minute and a half for questions. Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Atkinson, I'm looking at the dash sevens, and just from quickly reading them here, gives me, it appears that they say that the state of Oregon shall not cooperate with another state that would impose a tax on commerce that is done over the internet, even where that other state lawfully could impose that tax. For example, you have a company in one state, say Oregon, is selling product into, let's say, California, and the company does not have sufficient nexus with the state of California, thus that it does not require the company that is making the sale to collect the sales tax from the consumer. What I understand is California, they would impose a use tax in lieu of the sales tax, and the person who is buying the product would have to remit the use tax. As I read the dash sevens, it prohibits the state of Oregon to assist the California state of California in collecting that use tax. Am I reading that correctly?
Representative, Mr. Chair, Representative Witt, I believe you're probably a little bit more familiar with that particular example. I believe, in my intent on the dash sevens, that if the company does have nexus, that it would comply with the law. That's the first point. And then secondly, let me give you intent upon drafting. And an intent for me there was, I didn't believe philosophically that our state should be in the business of collecting taxes for other states. So I realize that's not direct, but that's part of where I'm coming from.
Well, maybe if I can direct this question to Ms. Archanko.
Sure.
I don't know if I described that situation accurately, but if you have a state that, for example, has a sales tax, if a company has nexus when it makes the sale under state law, it's required to collect that sales tax and remit it to the state. And that'd be true in Washington or in California, for example. However, if the company does not have nexus and it makes a sale, let's just say they use the internet in making the sale, and they ship the product into California, for example, they do not, under California law, or cannot be compelled, I guess, under California law, to collect that tax and remit it to the state of California. Does Oregon currently cooperate with states around it in that situation if they're requested to determine where these sales might have been made? To determine the origin of these products, for example, to make sure that use taxes are paid. I mean, a good example could be cigarettes that are shipped into this state. And our taxes aren't paid on them. But this would involve where products are sold over the internet, and the taxes would be due. But what we're saying is that this, under this dash 7, is the state of Oregon can't cooperate with another state to collect the tax that could be due to another state. What is the practice now relative to the state of Oregon?
Mr. Chair, Representative Witt, at this point in time, I'm familiar only with one instance in the past where a neighboring state was trying to ascertain whether there was sales tax collection liability on the part of an Oregon retailer for sales into a border state. And a request by the state tax authority in that state to the Department of Revenue for assistance for some information about that seller in order to aid the other state in determining whether there was sufficient connection to go to that seller and say, we think you've got an obligation to collect sales tax for sales into our state. Other than that, we have not had any active effort on the part of other states for assistance in collection. However, your point about the cigarette tax is a very appropriate one. We have learned over the last year or so that we've got a serious problem in collection of cigarette taxes. And in addition to concerted illegal activity of bringing into the state cigarettes intended to be sold in other countries and cigarettes that have been taxed in other states on a large scale, there is a very active internet marketing activity where cigarettes are coming into the state and the transaction is taking place through the internet, and we are cooperating actively with other states. There's a Western States group and there's also a national group that's trying to get a handle on how to enforce compliance with the laws that we all have on sale and consumption of cigarettes within our borders to collect those taxes. So the point is a very good one. We've got issues that we've got to work through around the use of the internet to accomplish transactions and taxes that are due because of those transactions.
Mr. Chairman?
We do need to finish this conversation, but not today. But go ahead, yeah.
Well, I mean, in passing something like that's in the Dash 7s, when you start telling one state Department of Revenue that you can't cooperate with other states in terms of taxes that might be due on sales that made through the internet, aren't you concerned that that starts to set a precedent that other states can start to adopt if you break down multi-state cooperation relative to sales that are made on the internet when taxes are due?
Mr. Chair, Representative Witt, yes, I agree with you.
It's a good place to take a break. We will invite everybody back next week. Paul, let's put this up on Tuesday. Let's just go ahead and stay right at this. Committee, I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 660. Before we go, I'll just run through my script, folks. The Chair requests unanimous consent that we reconsider the vote whereby the committee passed SJR 21 to the House floor. What? Oh, that's not on the script. What? Oh, it's over the top. It's even before number one. Okay, the Chair requests unanimous consent that we suspend the rules to allow reconsideration of the vote by which the committee passed SJR 21 to the floor. Is there any objection? Okay, we're in rules suspension. Chair moves that the vote whereby the moves reconsideration of the vote whereby the committee passed SJR 21A as amended to the floor with a due pass. Is there objection to that motion to reconsider the vote? Okay, hearing none. The chair requests unanimous consent to withdraw the motion whereby SJR 21 was moved to the House floor with a due pass recommendation as amended. Is there any objection to that request? And then the chair moves SJR 21 to the House floor with a due pass recommendation as amended, and that the subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded.
No, we have to do something.
Do we need a roll call on that? Any objection? Okay, that's done. Okay, what?
I didn't vote on it. I don't think I can vote because I didn't cast a vote.
Okay. Do you want to go back in and...
No, no, I'm not requesting
okay.
that.
Okay.
I don't want to procedurally mess this up.
Okay. Don't worry.
Okay.
We probably messed it up.
No way.
All right, Joan, you just make this look good. Okay, that takes care of 21. Thank you, Representative Witt.
Yeah,
the chair requests unanimous... Oh, wait, we are still in rules suspension. So, the chair moves that we reconsider the vote whereby the committee passed SJR 22A as amended to the House floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. The chair moves withdraw the motion whereby SJR 22 as amended was moved to the House floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. The chair moves SJR 22 to the House floor with a due pass recommendation as amended, and that the subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded. Is there any objection to that motion? Showing Representative Witt not participating. Okay, that is what I think we just did that. With that, we are adjourned, and see you on the floor.